down and troubled, and you need some love and care, and nothing is going right.
So, have you ever felt like nothing? No, nothing is going right? Well, cheer up. From Los Angeles, a big LA welcome to all my listeners out there in Radio Land. I am Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver, coming to you live globally through the famous worldwide Blog Talk Radio Network. Yes, folks, I'm the guy who's going to help you and guide you through this very difficult journey that we call caregiving. And we're going to do our very best to help you avoid that dreaded thing, it's so nasty sounding, called caregiver burnout. Does that sound nasty? It is. You don't want that. So we have an exciting show planned for you today. Director of the Families and Healthcare Project at the United Hospital Fund, Carol Levine, is here with us today. And we will be discussing why caregivers find it so stressful dealing with the healthcare providers and agencies. So stay tuned. You do not want to miss this show. I am your host, Dave Nassani, and this show is to caregivers of every kind. And the one thing we know about caregivers is that they are caring, selfless, sacrificial. Okay, I know, that's three. But they're also very prone to burnout because they tend to put everyone else's needs above their own. Occupational hazard. Folks, come on, learn a lesson from the airlines. Remember every time you board a plane, you tune them out when they start to tell you that if there's an emergency and the oxygen mask falls out of the ceiling and there's a loss of cabin pressure, to put your oxygen mask on first before you help your child with their mask. And the reason they tell you this is because they know that you will most likely black out if you don't put your needs above the needs of your loved ones. And then you won't be of any help to anybody. So, as I said, caregivers are exactly the same way. So we are here to help you all. And we also talk about grief and loss here and the devastating effects that it can have on us. Now, it automatically throws us into this thing. I know, just what we need, another thing called the grief process, which is even nastier than the first thing that I mentioned. Unfortunately, folks, there is only one way to get out of the grief process, and that's to go through the grief process. Yep. It sounds obvious. You can't go around it. You can't go under it. You can't go over it. You got to go through it. So hopefully we can help you through your grief and your loss if you happen to feel like you're stuck. Now, if this is the first time you're tuning in to our show, you can learn more about me and my show and the radio podcasts and my books and my videos and my blog. I know. It sounds like it's all about me, but it's not. It's actually all about you and what you guys are going through. So just go to my website, DaveTheCaregiversCaregiver.com, or the shortcut is just DaveNass.com. That's Dave and then Nancy, Apple, Sam, DaveNass.com. And when you go to my website, you want to take my short quiz, Are You a Candidate for Burnout? And guess what? Just for doing that, I'm going to send you a free link to my first book, One Arm, One Leg, 100 Words, Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships. It's about my amazing wife's story. And mine, of course, because I'm stuck in there, intertwined in the story. And that book is still getting rave reviews on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. So please don't miss out on this very informative quiz that will assess where you are in the burnout process. And the best part is you will get my book absolutely free just for doing that. I mean, Amazon is still selling for almost $10, so it's a great value. Now, let me take this moment to thank my last week's guest, Rick Lauber, who spoke on caregiving for boomers, the sandwich generation, elderly parent decisions, and you won't want to miss that. All of these interviews are on recorded podcasts, so just go to the website and listen to these things. They will bless you. All right, enough of that. I'm going to unmute my guest now, Carol Levine, or is it Carol Levine? How should I pronounce that, Carol?
It's Carol Levine.
I was right the first time. You should always go with your gut instinct. That's what I say. So, Carol, why don't you just take a moment and introduce yourself. Tell us who Carol Levine is.
Well, thank you, Dave, for inviting me here. What am I? Oh, my God. You're asking existential questions right off the bat.
Hey, Don't use big words.
big questions. I think of myself as a writer, as a researcher, as a mother, as a grandmother, as a person who was for 17 years the caregiver for her late husband. I am a person who's very interested in how people survive and in some places even thrive with these challenges that life throws at us. So I'm also a very avid reader. So I don't know where that fits in with all of this, but it does.
I'll have to send you my book.
Okay. And in my role here professionally at the United Hospital Fund, I direct a project that is aimed at helping family caregivers navigate the healthcare system, which, as you know, is an incredibly complex but also very important part of being a caregiver. So our goal here is to help caregivers work in partnership with the healthcare professionals. So we work with healthcare providers of all kinds in different settings and family caregivers. The main way we do this, at least publicly, is through our website, which is www.nextstepincare.org. And it has all kinds of guides for family caregivers and some for providers as well. So it's a way I turned my personal experience into a professional way of saying I'm doing this or I have done this. I think this is what, you know, how we can help other people going through the same experience.
Awesome. Now, you must be very smart to understand all of the complicated things that Obamacare has turned a complicated system even into a more complicated system, right?
Well, I do not put myself as an expert on all aspects of the healthcare system. What I am at least a semi-expert on is how family caregivers can be better informed about what they need to do and know to navigate the healthcare system. No one, I believe, understands every piece of the healthcare system. And frankly, a lot of what we caregivers deal with is the long-term care system, which is not part of the Affordable Care Act. It's its own world. It's all segmented, and so a lot of things are not covered in the in the general healthcare world. But
that's the free part of healthcare. All these caregivers just doing free stuff, and they don't get paid for. How can a caregiver actually get paid for being a caregiver? Right.
I have to say, Dave, this is a question that I get more and more these days, and I think it has to do with the big cost of healthcare, but also and home care, but also with the economy and so forth. There are a couple of ways. If the person you're caring for is on Medicaid, not Medicare, Medicaid, and you live in a state that has a program where the person with Medicaid can choose their home care attendants. The person can choose you, the family member, or anyone else they choose, and you can get paid for a certain number of hours. So there are big qualifications about that. That's really one of the few ways that you can get paid if the person you're caring for is has few resources, not enough to really pay you. Now, if your parent or whoever it is happens to have significant resources, that person can pay you. But there's a caveat here, and that you really, if you're going to go that route, you really need to talk to a lawyer and draw up a contract so that it's very clear, not just between you and the person you're caring for, but for other people in your family, exactly what you're doing for that money, how much you're getting paid, and so forth. Otherwise, you will wind up with some significant family problems. So
even if it's your mother or a close relative
even if it's your mother. If you've got two siblings and they're saying, wait a minute, Mom is paying you this amount of money? No, that's intended for all of us. So those are the kinds of things that can happen. You can't get paid at a, you know, say you're a big executive and you retire and you say, well, I can get paid my usual salary. No, you're going to get paid at the rate that a home care aide would get paid. So that's a significant decrease for many people. So it's not easy. It can be done under some circumstances, but it's worth exploring if you're having significant financial problems.
Yeah, I got a list of questions here that are pretty common questions, so I just want to just go down and get them out of the way. What's HIPAA, H-I-P-A-A? What is that all about?
HIPAA is the health, I can't even remember
what it's
called.
Is it health insurance, HI?
Health insurance, Portability and Accountability Act. Basically, it's the federal law that protects the privacy of your medical information.
Privacy.
It's a privacy law, and it has regulations attached to it. Unfortunately, it was introduced with a lot of training that emphasized the risk that professionals would get into with going to jail, paying huge fines, all of that stuff, if they even talked to a family member. That is not what the law says. The law is very clear. Healthcare providers can give relevant medical information to a family member or another person as long as the patient does not object. And even if the patient objects, there are some, you know, there are some ways of discussing it. So HIPAA has been used as a barrier to keep people from getting important information. I can tell you one person in a focus group who is a New York City police detective. You're from Brooklyn. You know what these guys are like. And this guy said, I can get information out of anybody, but when I go to the hospital, they won't tell me anything about my father.
That's funny.
It's tough. But if you know the law, and we have a guide that explains what HIPAA is, and if you can, you know, be very firm, and you point to what the law actually says, and I've interviewed the head of the agency that enforces the law, he says, there's no problem. You can get that information. So people should know that. They should not be put off by someone who says, I can't tell you because of HIPAA.
Yeah. Now, my mother is in the beginning stages, because I've been saying beginning stages for 2 years now. So she's got to somehow be in the intermediate stages of dementia. And she still recognizes me and stuff. And I've always known what hospice is, because we all know people who are dying of cancer and hospice comes in. But they told me something about palliative care, and I had no idea what that was. And it's actually a pretty cool thing. You don't have to wait till you're dying to have palliative care. Take a couple of minutes and just briefly explain what palliative care is.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the confusion you're describing is very common. As it happens, a healthcare executive came into my office today. She was here for something else, and she said, I don't understand what the difference between palliative care and hospice is. I said, oh, no, I can tell you, at least basically. Palliative care is care intended to control pain, control symptoms, to provide the best quality of life for someone who has a serious chronic illness, which may eventually be terminal, but at this point this person is not dying. And it's a complicated medical specialty at this point, and it's often given in hospitals, so that someone in a hospital who has experienced some catastrophic event or who is, you know, suffering from something, palliative care can ease their pain and help them through recovery. It can be given at home, but it's a little more complicated because of the financial arrangements. But it's basically not intended for someone who is imminently dying. It may at some point be transition to hospice care, which is for someone who has 6 months or less expected life expectancy.
Yeah.
But so it's really where on the trajectory of illness this person is, what the goals of care are, and I think it's there's so much confusion that people resist palliative care when what they're really thinking is that will mean this person is dying. It absolutely does not mean that.
Okay. Now, I want to get the definition of terms out, because once you start going to the hospital with your care receiver, you know, it's like they're speaking Greek, a different language. So what is a care coordinator? Because that term comes up once you're in the hospital.
Oh, a care coordinator. Well, as it happens, the New York Times Today has a column by Paula Spann in the New Old Age, and she quotes me, and she quotes she links to our guide on coordinating care. Care coordinators, and they can be called care managers, case managers, navigators, coaches. And she found a new term called Pathfinder, which is something I hadn't heard.
As if we weren't confused enough, let's just keep changing the same term to a million different meanings.
It's a person who is supposed to make sure that a patient gets the right care from the right person, the right provider, at the right time, and makes it all seamless. Now, if that sounds like you, the family caregiver, that's probably right. You're probably the one who's doing all of that. But the professional has a responsibility usually to their employer, whether it's the hospital or whether it's the health plan or whether it's another agency. So they have expertise, or they should have, in their own little piece of the puzzle that needs to be coordinated. So there have been a lot of efforts to do better care coordination, because so much of care is so fragmented. The problem, from my perspective, has been that there's so many care coordinators that it's up to the family to coordinate the coordinators. But basically, they're supposed to be the ones to put things together. But as you know, all caregivers know, a lot of it depends on the family member putting the pieces together and making sure that, you know, someone can get an appointment at the doctor's office for you, but you have to get your family member there at the right time and take off time from work and all of that stuff.
My wife, when she was in the hospital recovering from her stroke, this was like 1 or 2 weeks after her stroke, you know, she wanted to go to the restroom by herself for privacy reasons, and she fell down and broke her ankle. And this is a common thing, you know, because maybe your care receiver doesn't want you to walk them to the bathroom and something bad happens like my wife did. Or maybe it's just you're taking them to a doctor appointment and they want you to wait in the waiting room. Where should privacy begin and end with this? And what are great ways that you can, you know, talk about an embarrassing subject to an otherwise defiant care receiver?
Well, I think this is a common problem, particularly with older people who fear loss of independence more than they fear almost anything else. I think the best way to deal with this is to, for instance, say you're going to the doctor's office for a routine visit, not a catastrophe, and to talk about what you think is you want to accomplish at this visit, what problems have come up, who is going to raise those questions. And I think it's important to say, now, if there's some things you'd rather talk to the doctor alone, that's fine, and I'll sit in the waiting room, but I really need to be there when the doctor talks about your medications or any changes in what you're supposed to be doing so that I understand how to do this. So to offer the person, give them the respect and that they want in terms of respecting that there may be some things that they want to talk to the doctor alone. At the same time, you may say, you know, I need to talk to the doctor about a few things that are bothering
me.
Would be okay if I have a few minutes alone with the doctor or the nurse. So to to set the ground rules so that you can then feel more comfortable with it. And after the visit, you say, well, did that work? Did you feel comfortable? Is there mm-hmm. something we should change the next time? I think it's really, you know, you can't force it and you can't say absolutely everything, but to make sure that you both get out of the visit what you need, that's really the key.
Okay. Well, listen, we're up on a break, so we're going to take a couple of minutes. Don't go away, and we will be back momentarily.
One arm, one leg, 100 words. Overcoming unbelievable hardships. Available on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. Hear what Lynn Barrington, best-selling author of Daddies and Daughters, published by Simon & Schuster, has to say about it. You think you have it bad? Read this book. This is a beautiful, genuine story told from the heart. It's inspiring and easy to read. When you finish this book, you will be able to look at your concerns in a new light. How about the reaction of 9-time Grammy Award winner, the godfather of contemporary gospel music, Andre Crouch? This book will be an encouragement to anyone who reads it. Charlene just won't let the promises of God go. She's hanging on to her positive, godly attitude, and I look forward to the day when she will receive all that she's believing that God will do for her. In the meantime, she has not let her circumstances get in the way of her faith. Her smile has gotten just as big as it was before her stroke. She's not just a survivor, she's more than a conqueror, as the Bible states. I'm glad to know her and her testimony. Read this book. You will be encouraged regardless of what you're going through. So get your copy of One Arm, One Leg, and 100 Words, Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships today on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. But if you purchased it from the author's website, Dave and Charlene Nassani will personally autograph your own copy. Just go to DaveNass.com. That's Dave, and then N like Nancy, A like Apple, S like Sam, S like Sam.com. DaveNass.com. Oh, and while you're on his website, don't forget to leave your name and email address so that Dave can send you his free report, 10 Mistakes All Caregivers Make That You Shouldn't, just for visiting the site. There are a lot of resources, videos, and links to his radio podcast. Again, DaveNass.com. That's NASS. Now let's rejoin Dave Nassani and his guest on Dave the Caregiver's Caregiver Program on the Worldwide Blog Talk Radio Network.
And we are back with Carol Levine. Carol, you're still there, right?
Yes, I'm
good.
Still here.
I love it when I don't lose the guest. let's continue some of these common questions. Let's say your dad needs oxygen at home, but you don't know where you can get it or whether insurance will pay for it or how to use it. I mean, who can help with those kinds of difficult technical questions?
Well, all of those questions, whether it's oxygen or wheelchairs or hospital beds or diabetic supplies, all of that comes under this big heading called durable medical equipment. And we just put a new guide on our Next Step in Care website. I have to say it was one of the more complicated
guides we've
ever done. And I thought I knew, because I had a husband who used all that stuff, right? I thought I knew it. Well, no. First of all, it's a constantly changing set of rules and regulations. But basically, the idea is for any of those things, whatever they are, oxygen or the other things I mentioned, you really need the help of a really good professional person. It might be a physical therapist. It might be an occupational therapist. And those are people who work with, you know, more fine motor control and daily living activities. Or it might be a respiratory therapist with, say, with the oxygen. Sometimes nurses know some of this. Doctors, less so. I don't like to say they never know, but basically, this is a specialized area. So you want a referral from your doctor to either a home care agency or, you know, someone in their network who can help you find the right equipment for your situation, for the person you're taking care of, for some of these things for the space you have. You can't put all this big clunky stuff everywhere.
Right.
Now, oxygen equipment is not exactly like that, but some of the other things are. So my advice to someone who needs this is to find the right person to help you, and that person can tell you what the best will do an assessment of the person and of your home space, and mm-hmm. will help you figure out, you know, what is the best product and whether insurance will cover it. Most mm-hmm. insurances have some will cover some of it. Sometimes they will say you need to get it from a particular vendor, supplier, and how to take care of it, and if necessary, you know, how to get it repaired. I found that one of the biggest challenges I ever faced was trying to get my husband's wheelchair repaired. It just was impossible to get somebody to do it in a timely way, and you know, he needed it.
was it a power chair or manual?
It was not a power chair. It was you know, the old fashioned kind, and there was something wrong with it, and it was just so frustrating. And I know from other people that this can be a common problem. So you need to work with the people who are experts in this particular area, and you have to do a little research to find the right person.
Now, my mother sometimes can be very difficult. She's a perfectionist. She's a real finicky. And we hired this place called something about angels, you know, visiting angels or something like that. And they mm-hmm. come and they will help, you know, with the meals, help with dressing, mm-hmm. help with things like that, help with the cooking. And my mother, well, I don't like her. She doesn't, you know, mm-hmm. she doesn't look right. She doesn't smell right. She was on her phone, so I want somebody different. You know, what do you do when your loved one is just being so unreasonable? You know, you're paying good money for these people, and she's, you know, saying that she answered her phone and she shouldn't. I mean, what? Well, tell me about that.
Well, I think you need to, you know, when the person you're taking care of has to accept that they need the help of somebody else and that you can't be there all the time, or that it's a hard thing to accept. So they turn that anger and that resentment against the person who's come to help. It uh-huh. doesn't make sense, but you can begin to understand why that happens when you're perfectly charming and adorable grandmother says, you know, I'm firing this one. I won't have this person in my house again. I think
stealing the jewelry. You know, that's
right,
a good one.
That's right. Right. Oh, that's important. And all of those things. There is a sense of having. It's a loss on your, say your mother or your grandmother's part. It's a loss of not being able to be totally independent. Okay, so acknowledging that and then saying, okay, I understand that, but we really, you know, you really do need to have someone around. And tell me about what you think the ideal person would be. And try to, you know, get some ideas about would this person be a chatty person, someone I can talk to? Would I rather have this person just do the job and not talk to me? Would I rather have someone who cooks, you know, interesting meals, or is limited to three things that he or she can do?
Sure.
I think trying to, and then try to match, you know, what that need is with either an agency, or if you do it independently, with the kind of person that you think can do that job
mm-hmm.
and will be that kind of person. Now, there's no guarantee. But then you talk to the home care person and say, you know, this is what my mother really likes. This is what she values.
Right.
She likes to be told that, you know, she looks nice in the morning. She likes find the things that make her feel good. And it's more likely to establish a very comfortable relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And in my experience, food is the big issue. you know,
yeah.
I don't like the way this is happening. But try
right.
to find the way that will make it more comfortable, you know, without just saying, I don't care. You have to accept this person.
yeah, and
I'm
one of the lucky ones. I'm one of the lucky ones because there's people out there who don't even want a stranger in the house, who says, no.
Absolutely.
No, but you're doing everything. What do you mean you're sending stuff? Where are you going? You know, so
right,
how do we handle, you know, the opposite
well,
of that?
Well, I think that it's at a certain point that I hear all the time. And at a certain point, you have to say, you know, I can't be here all the time. I have to do whatever it is. I have a family to look after. I have a job to do. And if you are going to fall and nobody's here to help you, you're going to wind up, you know, incapacitated. It'll be worse. So I think at a certain point you just draw the line and say, you know, this will have to be. Otherwise, this situation can't go on. It'll be unpleasant, but you can't, you know, you can't sort of allow kind of this kind of pickiness.
Well, this sounds like role reversal. You know, the parents are starting to act like children. The children are starting to act like parents. And there's a whole lot of resistance on both sides because I didn't sign up for this.
Exactly. And I think if you do it in a way that is respectful and recognizes what's going on underneath. Sometimes the conversation is about the wrong thing. It's about, you know, the person or the something, when it's really about, I'm really scared. I really don't know what to do here anymore, and I'm worried about what's going to happen.
Then
you can get to a better arrangement.
Sure. Now let's talk about when something bad does happen. They have that fall, they break their hip or whatever. Urgent care or ER? Which do we pick?
Well, this is urgent care, and now we have retail clinics. And I think that urgent care has come about. I don't know what it's like in your neck of the woods, but it's all of a sudden it's springing up all over our area, and I have gone there. I have done it, and my family has done it. I think that what you need to know is that for ordinary things where you can't get a doctor's appointment right away, but the thing needs to be taken care of. In my case, it was I sliced my finger on doing something I shouldn't have done, or once I did something else, and you don't want to go to the emergency room. It isn't really an emergency, but it needs to be taken care of. Urgent care centers can do those sorts of jobs, or if it's, say, a cough that's gone on for a long time,
right,
or a fever. The better urgent care, the good urgent care centers are usually staffed by an emergency room trained physician. They can determine whether you really do need to go to the emergency room, and they can facilitate it. So what you need to save emergency rooms for are literally emergencies. Someone is profusely bleeding. Someone is unconscious. Someone is can't breathe. All of those kinds of things where it's only an emergency room can handle that.
So urgent care is like a doctor's office, only it's not your doctor.
It's not your doctor. And that is one of the problems is you want to also let your doctor or your parent's doctor, whoever it is, know that you had this visit to the urgent care center, because urgent care is a time-limited experience, and there's not necessarily going to be any communication with your regular doctor's office. So you want to let the doctor's office know, gee, you know, mom fell, and we thought she might have broken her hip, but it really wasn't. It was just a sprain, and she's okay, but I wanted you to know that it happened. Things like that. That you try to maintain at least some modicum of of continuity of care. Retail clinics, on the other hand, are really more, I think, for immunizations, for things that, you know, they're high class pharmacies. And they can do certain things, but they can't do other things. They can do blood pressure checks, they can do other sorts of things, but they're not equipped to do any kind of procedural things.
Yeah.
So knowing what's happening and where you need to go.
Yeah. Carol, let me ask you a question. Something that's really troubling me. You know, my wife had a stroke 19 years ago, and she stayed in the hospital for 6 weeks, you know, doing rehab and everything. I mean, she didn't come home until 6 weeks, and then she had 6 weeks home health care, and then she had 6 weeks of therapy outpatient. Now, a friend of mine just had a stroke recently, and in 4 days, they put her, she had a stroke, and they put her in a nursing home in 4 days. Now, what's going on? Mm-hmm. There's another woman who fell and was hospitalized for hip fracture, and immediately she went to a nursing home. So what changed here?
Well, what's changed in that period of time is that hospitals have become sort of they are the most expensive places of care. And so there has been a great push to provide care in less expensive but still appropriate levels of care. So
pregnancies as well, right?
I mean, this started with what's called, you may not have, this is jargon, DRGs, diagnosis related groups, which are methods of payment. And if somebody has a certain DRG, then, you know, the hospital gets a certain amount of money. So nursing homes have evolved from being places for long stay residents, mainly what the awful term custodial care, into places for short term rehabilitation, whether it's for stroke, fracture, or it could be for cardiac conditions, and that's a business, that's a profit center, if we don't call that a nonprofit setting. So people are being moved, as you said, very quickly from the acute care setting, the hospital, to a subacute or rehab setting. They can get the same level of physical therapy. In fact, some places have more because they're all set up for that. But it's another what we call transition in care, and it's difficult because there's new staff, there's different roles, all sorts of different things. The family's role is very different from in an acute care setting, and then there are limits on insurance coverage for short term rehab, and then you get home and so forth. So I think that what's happened has come about for economic reasons. It's not necessarily bad for the patient, but it does mean that there are a lot of changes, and in those transitions, the communication between the two facilities and the two doctors or the whoever is being involved is often not the best. So the family member is, again, the primary communicator and saying, this is what they told me in the hospital and this is what they're telling me here, and now, which one is it and how do I manage that? So it is part of the changing face of healthcare, but it's very, very common. What I really don't like, and I do hear this still, is where a hospital person will say to the patient, well, we're going to send you to a nursing home. They don't explain that it's not forever. It's for short term and it's for rehab. And so, people say, I'd rather go home. And they don't get the rehab that they need. So I don't know why they can't learn to say, you know, you really need some intensive
rehab. Yeah, I mean, they're
rehab.
Changing terms of everything else. Let's change that term, because when you say nursing home, I see this visual of a urine-infested, smelly place that people are kind of rotting in the corner. Please, service! They're ringing their bell, and people are ignoring them.
I mean, the short-term rehab is in some ways more like a gym. You know, they have more. It's much more oriented toward the physical rehabilitation, or in some cases, it's other kinds of rehab. So it's unfortunate, but you know, that's one of the things we keep telling the healthcare providers: explain what it is that you're doing.
Well, we're covering a lot of ground here, so thank you so much for your expertise. We're going to take another break, a couple of minutes. We'll be right back, and we'll spend the last segment talking about your book. That'll be fun. Not that this hasn't been fun. We'll be right back.
Tune in to Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver program, every Saturday at 3:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, only on the Worldwide Blog Talk Radio Network. The whole purpose of this show is to help support you in your caregiving responsibilities so that you take care of yourself first, so that you don't burn out, because your loved ones are counting on you to take care of them. And Dave Nassani should know. He's been a caregiver to his wife for over 19 years, after she suffered a debilitating stroke that left her severely speech impaired and paralyzed on her right side. After a 2-year grieving period, she came to the realization that she had to play the cards that she was dealt. And so she decided to reinvent herself and attempt to do all the things that she was famous for doing before her stroke, like gourmet cooking, hosting dinner parties for 12, interior decorating, sewing, and too many other hobbies and activities to mention here. She now basically makes us normal people look like whiners and complainers by continuing to do almost everything she did before her stroke. But in essence, she does it with one arm and one leg tied behind her back, and she might as well have duct tape over her mouth too, since she can't speak. And she does it all with her amazing positive attitude and smile. So what's your excuse for not playing the cards that you were dealt and turning those lemons into lemonade? Dave has been so inspired by Charlene's attitude that it inspired him to reach out to caregivers by writing 3 books and starting this radio program to make sure that caregivers have a place to go to get the support that they need in order to avoid burnout and to get through the grief process. Now get ready to learn how you can avoid burnout and survive grief. It's Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver, here on the Worldwide Blog Talk Radio Network. And here again is your host, Dave Nassani.
And we are back again with Carol Levine. Carol, let's talk about Living in the Land of Limbo. That's a curious title. You know, tell us everything about it. What was your inspiration? You know, why short stories? Why poems? Why fiction? How did you select the pieces? How is this different from memoirs? Because I don't think I've ever seen anything like this before.
Oh, well, okay. I'm happy to talk about this.
Yeah.
But, Dave, can I just mention that all of the questions we talked about and all the things we talked about, at least 9 out of 10 of them, we have family caregiver guides. So there's more information on our website, and it's free, and it's downloadable, and it's in 4 languages and all of that. So I just want to mention that, just because, you know, very short answers may not answer everyone's needs.
Sure.
Okay.
Give your website, just in case someone can't
stay through the whole show. Okay, it's www.nextstepincare.org. nextstepincare.org. Living in the Land of Limbo. I think I said when you asked me to talk about myself that I am an avid reader. Well, during the years that I was taking care of my husband, I really didn't sleep much because I had to be alert. As the title of another book I edited was called Always on Call, and that's how I always was, always on call. I found, you know, I couldn't read novels very much. It was too long, and I'd forget where I was, and I'd forget the plot. But I started reading a lot of short stories. It was as though I was finding caregiving in the short stories, and I wasn't looking for it. I wasn't looking for stories that were about caregiving. I was looking for stories that would help me get through the night. Then I decided, I said, wait a minute, this is about caregiving, and this poem is about caregiving, and I never thought about this kind of caregiving. And so I started collecting those things and think, wow, this is really interesting, because I'm learning about people's lives and caregivers through a different lens. It's not and then I did, and then this happened, and, you know, that kind of thing that I had done with and have talked to many caregivers, the sort of narrative of their experience. This was sort of through a prism of really excellent writing. And so I found actually poems that only a few of the stories that actually related to my own life as a caregiver, but that reading them all just gave me a greater understanding of what other people's lives might be like. And the way of that fiction and poetry does this, I think, for me, and it seems for a number of other people, is it kind of distills the emotional experience, so it's kind of the emotional essence of caregiving. It's what that relationship is all about. It's what and you can say things in poetry and fiction that you wouldn't dare say in real life, because, you know, oh, what a terrible person you are. You're angry at your husband. How could you say that? Yeah. You know, you can't, and people who are part of your family, how can you say that? Fiction, when it's well done, does that, and at the same time, it's a kind of emotional release, because you've experienced something through the eyes of a person that you know is not real. So I collected these stories and poems in a big box, and then I said, wait a minute, you know, maybe there's a book here. And I looked around to see if there was, you know, you do the standard thing, is there anybody else has done this? And no one else had done it. So I really started working on trying to collect them into an anthology. The title actually came to me as an easy, easy thing, because I was reading the work of Arthur Kleinman, who is an anthropologist and psychiatrist, and he talked about people who live through chronic illness as living in a land of limbo, because they never quite know when the next episode is going to happen or what. He talked about the people who accompany them on this journey as also being part of the land of limbo. And all of a sudden, that's where I am. I didn't know where this was going to end. Right. I didn't know what it was going to be like. So I said, that's my title. That was the easy part. The hard part was getting a structure for the book. Eventually, I decided on, since I believed that the essence was relationships, and not the disease, not the, you know, anything else, but the relationships. The book is divided into the relationships: children of aging parents, spouses or partners, parents of sick children, other kinds of relatives or friends, and then finally, what we were just talking about, paid caregivers and their feelings about working for people who, they're not just working for the person, they're also working in that family's situation that may or may not be so comfortable for them. It was enlightening for me, and I had to not include some things that I really wanted to, but mostly things I did was able to include. I had a wonderful, wonderful publisher, Vanderbilt University Press, who helped me all along the way and were very supportive of what I was trying to do. The response has been really quite interesting in that the reviews, and you know you've written books, so the reviews can pick out one or another thing, and each of the reviewers has picked out something different. That's made me feel that it speaks to different people in different ways, which is what I really wanted.
I'd love for you to do a reading of maybe a poem or something else that you think would be appropriate or moving.
I can do two.
Yes.
Actually, let me start with this is one of my favorite pieces, and it's actually, I think, one of the first pieces in the book. It's a short story by Julie Otsuka, who is a Japanese-American writer, and it's called D.M. Perdidi. Now, that term means I have lost the day. We don't hear that one as much as carpe diem. Carpe diem, seize the
day. That's Latin?
This is,
yes.
That's Latin, and so is D.M. Perdidi, I have lost the day. Let me just read the opening paragraph. She remembers her name. She remembers the name of the president. She remembers the name of the president's dog. She remembers what city she lives in and on what street and which house. She remembers what year it is. She remembers the season. She remembers the day on which you were born. She remembers the name of the man she did not marry, Frank, and she keeps his letters in a drawer by her bed. She remembers that you once had a husband, but she refuses to remember your ex-husband's name. That man, she calls him. She does not remember how she got the bruises on her arms or going for a walk with you earlier this morning. She does not remember what she ate for dinner last night or when she last took her medicine. She does not remember to drink enough water. She does not remember to comb her hair. And then it goes on. So it's all about what this woman who, as it turns out, was interned with the Japanese Americans during World War II. So she remembers all of that, but she, you know, she doesn't remember some of the things that are happening right to her right this minute. And so the story is about memory. It's about what we remember. Even in cases of dementia, we remember some things, but we don't remember other things. Mm-hmm. And it's just a very evocative story about looking at dementia from the caregiver's perspective, but also sort of chronicling what the mother remembers and doesn't remember. Mm-hmm. So I love that story because I think it gave me an insight into dementia in a way that is not... She doesn't remember anything. She remembers everything. It's,
sure.
It's a kind of phrase. It's a kind of, what should I say, a way of, that changes, and maybe one day she'll remember something that she didn't remember. So I think that's a very useful and interesting story. Now, this
Beautiful.
Is one poem that I like. It's called Where the Groceries Went. It's by Raymond Carver, who is better known as a short story writer, but he was also a poet. He is deceased. And this is Where the Groceries Went. When his mother called for the second time that day, she said, "I don't have any strength left. I want to lay down all the time." "Did you take your iron?" he wanted to know. He sincerely wanted to know. Praying daily, hopelessly, that iron might make a difference. "Yes, but it just makes me hungry, and I don't have anything to eat." He pointed out to her that they'd shopped for hours that morning, brought home $80 worth of food to stack in her cupboards in the fridge. "There is nothing to eat in this goddamn house but bologna and cheese," she said. Her voice shook with anger. "Nothing." "And how's your cat? How's Kitty doing?" His own voice shook. He needed to get off this subject of food. It never brought them anything but grief. "Kitty," his mother said. "Here, Kitty, Kitty." "She won't answer me, honey. I don't know this for sure, but I think she jumped into the washing machine when I was about to do a load. Before I forget, the machine's making a banging noise. I think there's something wrong with it. Kitty, she won't answer me. Honey, I'm afraid. I'm afraid of everything. Help me, please." "Then you can go back to whatever it was you were doing, whatever it was that was so important that I had to take the trouble to bring you into this world." End of poem. So you feel both this fear and fright, but you feel the son's frustration.
I've been moved.
This is such a difficult time, you know. His mother is, you know, she forgets that he spent $80 worth of food, and she's put the kitty in the washing machine. And so there's a sense of, you know, sense of both people are locked in this sort of struggle, and you feel for
sure.
both of them.
So I think you
got
me.
That's the kind of thing. Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, they're different ones, and there are some that are actually a little funny. Not too many, but they're not sad too much in the sense of, you know, you read it and oh no, I don't really want to know about that. There's a sense of reality and urgency, and you know, you've distilled the experience, as I said before. So
yeah.
it's been interesting to see the responses, and I think it's in now I have a new box and I have new stories and poems and
good.
May turn out to be another book.
Well, Carol, I don't know where the time has gone. It's been an hour already talking to you. It was a wonderful hour, and for those of you tuning in, thank you so much for tuning in, and you can listen to this as many times as you want, or if you know friends who you wished were hearing this, it's all recorded on the podcast. Go to my website. Carol, thank you again for allowing me to interview you, and thank you to everyone else who tuned in today. Remember, our shows are Wednesday at noon Pacific time every week, and don't forget, all our shows are recorded podcasts. You can listen to them on Dave, the Caregivers, caregiver.com, or the short link, DaveNass.com, Nancy, Apple, Sam. And by the way, when you're on my site, do not forget to take that quiz, Are You a Candidate for Burnout?, so that you can assess where you are in the burnout process, and to get your free copy of my book, One Arm, One Leg, 100 Words, Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships. You will be encouraged and uplifted by doing both, and I'm going to send you a copy, Carol, because you are an avid reader, right?
I am. Indeed I am. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you again, and until next week, may God richly bless you. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for joining Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver Radio Show. Make sure you tune in every Wednesday at noon Pacific, 3 o'clock Eastern, to catch more of Dave and his tips to caregivers on avoiding burnout and surviving the grief process, right here on the Worldwide Blog Talk Radio Network.